We're going to wrap up today the discussion of anomalies. And just to reiterate what we discussed last time, anomalies are problematic in gauge theories just from the point of view of preserving the gauge theory. If we want a gauge theory if we want a gauge symmetry that's not broken through quantum mechanical loop corrections, we want to ensure that all of the gauge anomalies in the theory vanish. The only way to make them vanish is to choose the appropriate charges such that the prefactor entering into the calculation of these triangle diagrams vanishes. And so that imposes a constraint on the charges in the theory. So we wanted to apply this to the standard model. And this is the formula we derived in our Torrey model theory, which just had a U1, a chiral U1, coupled to just a bunch of different fermions labeled by I. We can apply this straightforwardly to the standard model for the case of hypercharge. That's a U1 with chiral interactions. And so I'm going to go over here and make a list. So for hypercharge, we had E mu J mu y was G prime squared over 32 pi squared. And then we had some now over the hypercharges for the left-handed fermions minus the sum over the hypercharges for the right-handed fermions. Then I'd have to write B mu nu. Okay, and so if we wanted this coefficient to vanish, it imposes a constraint on the hypercharges. So we have this condition that the prefactor vanishes. Okay, so this will be equation one. And for the triangle diagram, you can think of it as coupling to the hypercharge current at each of the three vertices. And so the notation that we use for this is hypercharge U1 cubed anomaly. Okay. All right, so now we want to also generalize our formula, not to the case of we just have one U1 gauge group, but we want to consider a situation like the standard model where we have multiple gauge groups.
I have a general question, which is, so we are requiring this prefactor to disappear so that we don't have to worry about corrections at loop level. Is there ever anything that would guarantee that the anomaly will never show up at loop level?
Yeah, so it turns out that the anomaly calculation, which we haven't done, but it's a one-loop calculation, is exact. And so there's no additional corrections that arise at higher loop. Okay. So as long as we cancel out these, we're good. Okay. So we want to generalize to the case of many gauge groups together. And in that case, you can imagine different gauge interactions at each of the three vertices. And so there's all sorts of different permutations you can imagine. So this will be the case of mixed anomalies. Where we have, for theories with multiple gauge groups, so it turns out in the standard model, there's only one type of mixed anomaly that's important. And this is the case where I have still hypercharge here. And then I have my triangle diagram. But then instead of coupling to the hypercharge current here, my hypercharge external field, I could couple to some other external field for one of the other gauge groups. So this, in general, will couple to some other field. Not necessarily hypercharge, but the U2, the SU2, or the SU3 gauge fields. So I'll just write this generically as gauge fields index nu as before. But now I have to attach an extra group index A. And it still has momentum P1. This will have momentum P2, and then some other indices, B and beta, like so. Okay. So this is a gauge field for SE2 left or SE3 color. Okay, so the situation is, it's qualitatively similar to what we had before. Before we argued that if you had this hypercharge anomaly, you can imagine turning on a hyperelectric and magnetic field to create some hypercharge. Here, it's still also problematic. If you turn on some color electric and magnetic field, you would still create some hypercharge. So that's kind of the setup to have in mind here. Okay, so it's the same calculation as before. It's nothing more complicated here, except at these vertices, we have to imagine that we'll insert some generators, TA. So instead of having G times gamma nu, for example, here, we would also insert a generator. And so at the end of the day, when we take the trace over this fermion loop, we'll also have the trace of the generators appearing. Okay, so now I'll go over here. This will be the U1 SE2 left squared anomaly. So we get the formula for the hypercharge, divergence of the hypercharge current, G squared over 32 pi squared, sum over left-handed fermions times their hypercharge, and then the trace of TA TB times epsilon mu nu alpha beta WA mu nu WB alpha beta. All right. I put in one little bit here where instead of summing over the left-handed ones minus the right-handed ones, the generators are only for the left-handed fermions in the standard model. All of the right-handed fermions transform in the trivial representation of SE2 left, and so those generators would all be zero. So these are just the generators for the left-handed ones. All right, so now I can simplify this a little bit more by using the fact that the trace is 1/2 delta AB, and then I have G squared over 64 pi squared. I have a sum over left-handed fermions, y left I, and then epsilon mu nu alpha beta, wa mu nu, wa alpha beta. Okay, so in general, this will give me something non-zero unless the prefactor vanishes. So I have to require that the sum of the hypercharges for the left-handed fermions must vanish. So this is our second equation. All right, and then we have another one to think about. So now let's do SU3 instead of SU2. So we have this mixed anomaly. It's the same as what we did for SU2. There's only two differences. One is that because only the quarks couple to SU3 color, we're only going to have quarks in this triangle loop. We'll have both left and right-handed fermions. So we'll have a left-handed term minus a right-handed term. So it looked like this. So I'll have GS here over 64 pi squared, and then a sum over the left-handed quarks only. minus a sum over the right-handed quarks. And then I have epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then ga mu nu ga alpha beta. Okay, so again, we want this to vanish. The prefactor has to vanish. So we get equation 3. So here's another equation. Then lastly, there's one other type of diagram to worry about, which is that we can imagine having this triangle diagram where we attach on the right-hand side not any of the forces in the standard model, but the force of gravity. And so we could attach gravitons to these points and ask, is the anomaly consistent with also including gravity? So gravity also contributes to the anomaly. So there's a lot of steps here that I'm not going to go through. How do we work out Feynman diagrams including gravitons? I'm not going to discuss that at all. But I'll just mention very, very superficially what you would do. So you would want to work out the graviton couplings. Matter. And so the basic idea is that you work in just a linearized theory where you expand the metric around Minkowski space plus a perturbation, which has an overall prefactor times some fluctuation. The prefactor is probably just to put the kinetic term for this fluctuation part in canonical form. But I haven't gone through this in detail. OK? And then you would work out all the Feynman rules. Where the fluctuation couples to matter via the stress energy tensor T mu nu. OK, so assuming we've done all that, you can write down a triangle diagram where still I'm computing the divergence of the hypercharge through this triangle diagram. But now I'm attaching gravitons here, H mu nu, H alpha beta. So you can think of this as some source of charge in some non-trivial space-time background, effectively. So we get an equation like this for the current conservation. There's one small subtlety here, and that is that the rule or the formula for current conservation is just slightly different in a curved space-time background. Instead of just writing j mu nu here, I have to write the determinant of g. J mu nu. And so this is effectively just like the covariant derivative of J mu nu, of J mu. And I'm not 100% sure in these prefactors, but this is what I think is correct. There's a factor of 768 pi squared times a sum over the left-handed fermions of their hypercharge minus a sum over the right-handed fermions of their hypercharge. And then we have epsilon mu nu alpha beta, and then the Riemann tensor. R mu nu sigma tau, R alpha beta sigma tau. OK, this is Riemann tensor. All right, so again, we want the prefactor to vanish again. So we have this condition where the sum of the hypercharges now, the left-handed ones minus the sum for the right-handed ones, must be equal to 0. So this would be equation 4. And this is the U1 gravity squared anomaly. OK. So those are all of the equations that we have. In general, you could imagine other types of mixed anomalies or other types of anomalies involving three-gauge, non-abelian gauge fields. I haven't discussed those because all of those are trivially satisfied in the standard model. These are the only ones that are non-trivial. And so they imply a series of consistency conditions for all of the hypercharges. So we have four consistency conditions. 4, 5 hypercharges. We had the hypercharge for the left-handed quark doublet, left-handed lepton doublet, the right-handed lepton, the right-handed up quark, and the right-handed down quark. So we have 4 equations and 5 unknowns. And so it's a question, first of all, are these equations all satisfied in the standard model? If they are, then you can also ask the question, are they uniquely satisfied in the standard model? Could you have chosen the hypercharges to be something else and still satisfy all of these conditions? So those are the questions. I won't tell you the answer. You'll have to figure it out on your own. But you're going to be discussing it in tutorial, so you'll have a chance to figure it out. OK. So that's all I want to say about anomalies. But I think it's really nice from the point of view of we started writing down the standard model, and we introduced all of these different numbers, the hypercharges for all of the different fields. And it seemed a little bit ad hoc at the time. So the anomaly conditions give us a way to understand why those hypercharges have to be the way they are in order for the theory to make sense. All right. Next, so far we've only been talking about gauge anomalies, which are problematic just from the underlying theoretical point of view. Next, I want to talk about the other type of anomaly, which are global anomalies. And I specifically want to talk about them in the standard model. Global anomalies are not problems from a theoretical point of view. They don't signal a breakdown of the theory itself. They just imply that a symmetry that we thought was a symmetry based on the classical tree-level Lagrangian is actually not a symmetry after all. So you can break a symmetry that you thought was a symmetry. Okay. Violation of a global symmetry. Of the classical theory. I.e. the tree-level theory. Now, there's different things we can discuss here. I'm only going to discuss a subsection, but I want to mention one thing, which is that some of these global anomalies do have experimental implications, and so they can be tested. And we see that these anomalies actually are there in nature. So I just want to mention very briefly some of the experimental consequences before I talk about a different global symmetry. And so these come from a violation of chiral symmetry. In the standard model. One implication is that it allows the neutral pion to decay through a triangle diagram into two photons. And so this is something that you can compute based on the anomaly calculation that we did, and you can compute the rate. So that's one way to test that these anomalies actually occur. Another way that these anomalies manifest is by giving mass to one of the mesons of QCD, the eta prime. It acquires its mass through a triangle diagram, which you can think of like this. You might ask, why did we need an anomaly to give mass to this one particular meson? Well, it was kind of a puzzle for a long time. You can show, based on some group theoretic arguments, that the mass of the eta prime, you would naively expect it to be fairly light, sort of comparable to the mass of the pion, or the masses of the kaons, or the masses of another meson called the eta. This is the expectation, based on group theory. You'd expect it to be degenerate with other particles like this, which have a similar spin in quantum numbers. However, experimentally, its mass is much larger. The mass is around 950 MeV, which is much, much greater than the masses of all of these things. So it's a little bit of a puzzle that people finally understood, as there's this extra contribution to the anomaly contributing to the eta prime mass. OK, so I just mentioned this very briefly. But I want to talk in more detail about some other aspects of global anomalies in the standard model. So we also discussed U1 baryon number and U1 lepton number as accidental global symmetries in the standard model. And so it turns out that both of these symmetries, which arise at the tree-level Lagrangian, are actually violated through the anomaly. So let's just talk about baryon number to start with. So the baryon number current is a sum over all fermions. And I should write down the baryon number for those fermions. And then psi bar I gamma mu psi. So the baryon number for quarks would just be 1/3. And then the baryon number for everything else, like the leptons, would just be 0. So OK, the sum only runs over the quark fields. If I just expand it out, I have the sum over generations. The three generations, I have 1/3 q bar left gamma mu q left plus 1/3 u right I gamma mu u right plus 1/3 d right I gamma mu d right I. Okay, so this current is anomalous. I can imagine computing a diagram like this. Um, it will give me a non-zero answer. And so I want to show that it's going to be non-zero. There's two anomalies that we have to worry about. One is where the external gauge fields here are the hypercharge gauge fields. And the other is where these external gauge fields are SU2 gauge fields. So we can just go through and use the formula that we already derived. So this should be the hypercharge part should be g prime squared over 32 pi squared. And then I have a sum over the left-handed ones minus the sum over the right-handed ones times epsilon mu nu alpha beta b mu nu b alpha beta. And it's really similar to what we did with the three hypercharge insertions. For that case, where we had hypercharge current here, we had y, y, and y. And so that's why we got y cubed in each of these terms. Here, we just have to trade one of the y's at this insertion for the corresponding baryon number. So I should get the baryon number for this particular fermion. But then I have the hypercharge squared. And then this one would be the baryon number times the hypercharge for the right-handed fermion squared. OK. These b's are just one-third, as long as I recognize that this sum should only be going over the quarks. OK, so that part straightforward. Then I have the same thing for the SU2 gauge fields. I'll have g prime over 64 pi squared. And then I have a sum over the left-handed fields, bi, and then just like this. And then epsilon mu nu alpha beta, wa mu nu, wa alpha beta. Yeah.
What does it mean to think of the baryon current as the source?
So you want to kind of think of it in the same way as we set up the problem yesterday. You're asking, if we turn on an external electric and magnetic field here, we would now have a source of baryon number. So that might seem a little bit weird. You know, why can't we just turn on in a laboratory an electric and magnetic field that are parallel to each other and create baryons? That would be nice, but we can't do that. But I'll show you why that doesn't emerge. But for now, we're just calculating this diagram. And it is non-zero. We're going to compute these coefficients and just plug in the numbers. It will be non-zero. OK. So let's evaluate these overall coefficients. So for the first term, we have the stuff in parentheses is we have a one-third for the baryon number. We have three generations. And we have all of the different colors going in the loop as well. So we have three for color. So this is the baryon number, this is generations, and this is color. And then now we have to do the hypercharges, which are different for the different cases. For the case of y left, the hypercharge is a sixth, and then I square it. And then I also multiply by 2 because I have still an SU2 doublet going around. I have to also count all of the degrees of freedom. I have q left, which is u left and d left. So I have another factor of 2. for SE2 left doublet. So now the right-handed ones, I have 2/3 squared, and then minus 1/3 squared. Okay, so you evaluate this, you get minus 3/2. We can do the second term. It's there's 1/3 for the baryon number. There's 3 for color. There's 3 for generation. And that's it. So this is just 3. OK, so here's the final results. dmu jmu b is 3 g squared over 64 pi squared, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, w a mu nu, w a alpha beta, minus 3 g prime squared over 64 pi squared, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, b mu nu, b alpha beta. Okay. All right, so we get something non-zero. And before we discuss some of the implications of this, let's also talk about the case of lepton number. It's very similar, except there's one small difference. So let's first just write down the lepton current. So L is supposed to be the lepton number for whatever field you want. We can expand this out as a sum over generations. And so I have the left-handed lepton doublet I, gamma mu, left-handed lepton doublet I, plus the right-handed electron field, charged lepton fields, generation I. Okay, so it looks similar so far to the case of the baryon calculation, but the big difference is we haven't included any right-handed neutrino. Okay, so there's no right-handed neutrino here. And so the calculation is exactly the same as what we had before for the baryon number currents. We had an anomaly for hypercharge. We had an anomaly contribution for SE2 left. But because we don't have any right-handed neutrino fields, we also get a gravitational anomaly as well. So there's no right-handed neutrino. So we also have U1L, U1Y squared. We have U1L SU2 left squared. And then we also have the U1L gravity squared anomalies. So this is the one that you get now because we don't have the right-handed neutrino field. And also just a little bit of notational confusion. The L for the U1 is lepton number. the L for the SU2 is left. So hopefully that's not too confusing. All right, so I can write down what the current, the divergence of the current is. We had 3 G squared over 64 pi squared, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, WA mu nu, WA alpha beta, minus G prime squared over 64 pi squared times 3, epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, B mu nu, B alpha beta. And then we have the term from gravity, which, again, I'm not 100% sure on the prefactor, but this is what I found. 1 over 256 pi squared, epsilon, mu nu, alpha beta, and then r, mu nu, sigma tau, r alpha beta, sigma tau. OK, so we have this additional term due to gravity. And I just want to mention, why does this come in? Well, remember, when we compute the gravitational anomaly, we got terms proportional to here. We'd have the lepton number I for the left-handed fields. I'm not sure how I want to denote this. Li, left-handed fields. So the lepton number for the left-handed fields minus the lepton number for the right-handed fields. OK, so it's basically 1 for the left-handed neutrino, 1 for the electron left-handed, minus 1 for the right-handed electron, but there's no extra minus 1 for the right-handed neutrino. And so this whole thing does not vanish because we don't have this perfect balance between the left and right-handed chiralities. OK. OK, so what we showed is that baryon and lepton number, which are accidental symmetries of the Lagrangian at tree level, and experimentally, they seem to be symmetries. We haven't observed any baryon or lepton non-conservation to date, are not actually symmetries of the theory due to these anomalies. So then the question is, if these symmetries are violated, why haven't we observed baryon and lepton number violation? OK, so then the first thing that you might worry about is, well, I know there's some component of these fields involving photons, the photon fields. And if I expand this out, do I get a term that's purely involving electromagnetic fields? If that were the case, you would just need to do E dot B in your laboratory to make baryons and leptons. So are there terms proportional to epsilon mu nu, alpha beta, F mu nu, F alpha beta, which is equal to minus 8 E dotted into B. So what you would want to do is expand the W3 and B in terms of photon and Z, the physical fields. And then what you find is that actually terms like this do not appear. So you would expand W3, or not really expand, but substitute in W3, which, oh, I forget off the top of my head, it's cosine theta W, Z, and then I think it's a plus here, sine theta W, A. And then also B mu would be minus sine theta W Z mu plus cosine theta W A mu. OK? So it turns out that because tangent theta w is g prime over g. And the prefactors here are g squared and g prime squared. These terms like this actually disappear and cancel between the two terms. So they do not appear. OK, so that is OK. So we can't make just I can't adjust the magnetic and electric fields in the lab to make neutrons and protons or leptons. OK, fine. So that tells you that if you do want to violate lepton and baryon number, it has to involve the weak fields. It has to involve the W and Z. So it must involve the W fields and the Z. So that means that if you want to excite, make some configuration of the weak gauge fields, you need to pay an energy cost because of the Higgs mechanism, which gives mass to these fields. Okay, and this particular situation where you pay this energy cost to excite some configuration in the gauge fields, which then can violate baryon and lepton number, is a particular gauge configuration known as a sphaleron. And so the way you can think of it is that there's an energy cost associated with a sphaleron, which turns out to be of order the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs field. And there's actually a prefactor, which turns out to be 4 pi over g. And this turns out to be around 10 TeV. So in other words, because there's a mass associated with these fields, you have to pay this energy cost. And this is a large amount of energy. So it's hard to get this amount of energy in the laboratory. And so that's why we haven't been able yet to see this effect experimentally. And another way to think of it is you can imagine making a plot of energy versus baryon number. So suppose we start out in a universe with baryon number 0. You can think of this sphaleron as kind of an energy cost to making baryons. So you can think of it as sort of this potential barrier like this. OK, so if I want to violate baryon number or lepton number, I have to go from one minimum to the other by exciting this particular gauge field, this sphaleron. And there's just this energy cost to do so. OK.
Question.
Yeah.
So because there's a baryon asymmetry in our universe, in the early universe, we would have exceeded these.
Yes, exactly.
So could you have created enough baryons by this mechanism?
Yes. So that is one of, so these sphalerons are one of the key ingredients for many different mechanisms of baryogenesis. But the sphaleron by itself is not enough. Just because you have enough energy in the early universe to go over the barrier this way doesn't mean that you wouldn't also go over the barrier in the other direction. So you need some extra ingredient, some source of CP violation that biases you towards going one way versus going the other. OK, but that is a great point. So I want to mention that there's actually three ways to explore the physics of sphalerons, or I should say three ways to go over the barrier or to go from one minimum to the other. So the first is that you can tunnel. You don't necessarily have to go over the barrier if you can quantum mechanically tunnel through the barrier. However, at zero temperature, the rate is really small. It's proportional to this non-perturbative prefactor that goes like the exponential of minus 8 pi squared over g squared. And if you plug in the gauge coupling g for the SU2 gauge group, this number is like 10 to the minus a lot. I forget what it is off the top of my head. OK, so this factor here means that if you compute the rate for a baryon to tunnel, the rate is astronomically tiny. Okay. Now, the third way to go is exactly as you mentioned, at high temperature. In the early universe, the temperature was a lot higher. Now, of course, I don't have enough time to discuss the dynamics of the Standard Model in the early universe, but the situation actually gets a lot better at high enough temperature due to a phenomenon known as symmetry restoration. So it turns out that if you go towards high enough temperature, eventually the Higgs field is no longer spontaneously broken. The Higgs SU2 left cross U1 symmetry actually gets restored. And so the VeV of the Higgs field at high temperature becomes zero. The energy of the sphaleron is proportional to the Higgs VeV. And so the height of this barrier actually goes to zero at sufficiently high temperature. OK? So although you would have enough energy to go over the barrier, actually, the barrier comes down. And so it's no longer suppressed. OK, so the barrier goes away for temperatures much, much larger than the Higgs VeV. OK, and then the third way to explore it is just at a high enough energy collider, you'd be able to excite enough energy in principle to go over the barrier. This part I'm not super familiar with, but it really seems inconceivable using present accelerators. But people are talking about building colliders at 100 TeV, and now people are starting to think, well, is that enough energy to actually produce these sphalerons in the laboratory? That would be an amazing thing, to actually see the sphaleron in the laboratory. And then you would really have confidence that you would be able to use it for baryogenesis, let's say, in a cosmological context. OK, but this is really like a far future collider. OK. All right. So.
The LHC about at that scale right now?
Yeah, for sure it is. So it's at 13 TeV. But it's actually really hard to, like, with the LHC and you're colliding protons together, the protons have so many different constituents, you know? And all of the different constituents are sharing all of the momentum. So you can't really use all of that energy in one particular scattering. Another way to think about how difficult it is to make a sphaleron is that you know that the mass of the W is around 100 GeV. And so this energy is around 100 times greater than that. And so it's like, you can think of a sphaleron as like a coherent state of 100 W bosons all put together. So that's really, takes really a large amount of energy to do that. And it's, OK. OK, any other questions on this? Now, we have 10 minutes left. And there's one missing piece which we didn't discuss, which is actually calculating this anomaly diagram. And so it's actually a long calculation that took me several days to do. But we could squeeze it into 10 minutes. Should we try that? OK. Now, the calculation is a bit long and tedious, but I want to just highlight the subtleties of the calculation. So let's evaluate the triangle diagram. Okay, so we'll only do the first diagram. The second diagram is obtained by symmetrizing P1 and nu to P2 and beta. Okay, so the first diagram is B4k over 2 pi to the fourth. And we wanted to evaluate the trace of q slash gamma 5, k slash minus p slash 2, gamma beta, k slash gamma nu, k slash plus p1 slash, and then over the denominators for the three propagators, we had k squared, k plus p1 squared, k minus p2 squared. Okay, so this is the thing that we wanted to evaluate. So we had three insertions of the vertex, three propagators, and this is what we have to evaluate. So there's a trick for evaluating this. Let's say we have q slash, which is q is p1 plus p2, and so I'll write it like this. And I'll just add and subtract k. So let's say we have k slash plus p1 slash, and then minus k slash minus p2 slash. So I just added and subtracted k. The reason why we did this is as follows. Here I'll have k plus p1, which, due to the cyclic property of the trace, can go to the other side and contract with this k slash plus p1. If you have gamma, you know, a slash, p slash, that just gives you p squared. And so this whole thing will give me k plus p1 squared, which will cancel this k plus p1 squared. Similarly, I have k minus p2 slash, which will combine with this k minus p2 slash to give me k minus p2 squared, which will cancel this one. So I can write it as these two terms together. I'll have, so the first term will look like I'll have a gamma 5, and then I'll still have k minus p2 slash gamma beta, k gamma nu, and then the p1 will cancel this, and then the whole thing will be over k squared, k minus p2 squared. And then the other term will, so I have a minus sign here. This will go through the gamma 5 to be flipped to a plus sign. So I'll have a plus gamma 5, gamma beta, k slash, gamma nu, k slash plus p1 slash over k squared, k plus p1 squared. Okay, so now let's do the following. In this first term, we're just gonna shift our momentum integral to let k go to k plus p2. So then this first term will go to the following. I'll have gamma 5 times k slash. I have gamma beta. I'll have k slash plus p2 slash gamma nu over k squared k plus p2 squared. And then in this other term, what I'll do is I'm just going to use, first of all, the cyclic property of the trace to move this gamma beta over here. And I'm also going to anti-commute the gamma 5 through this as well. So I get a minus sign here, which is gamma 5 k slash gamma nu k slash plus p1 slash gamma beta over k squared k plus p1 squared. so this is just using the cyclic property plus anti-commute gamma 5. All right. Now, this whole thing is anti-symmetric if I swap P1 and P2 and also nu and beta. So now when I combine this one, which is anti-symmetric, with matrix element 2, which is just a symmetrized version, the whole thing will give me 0. So it gives 0 when combined. With matrix element 2 by symmetry. Okay. So now you might say, well, maybe this sets all of the anomalies to 0, but there's a subtlety here that we missed. The subtlety is as follows. So if you count the powers of k under the integral, you can see that this whole integral is going to be divergent. It'll actually have a linear divergence. And so when you get things that are vanishing but also have divergent integrals, you have to be a little bit careful because you could have the product of something that goes to 0 times something that's divergent giving you something finite. So it has a linear divergence. So you must be careful because if you have 0 times a divergent quantity, it may be finite. So let's compute it by regulating the integral. And there's different ways to regulate the integral. None of them are really satisfying for the point of view of computing this anomaly. But I'm going to do the one that's most familiar, which is just using dimensional regularization. So instead of working in 4 dimensions, we'll work in d dimensions. OK, so we have this 4-dimensional integral k. Goes to a d-dimensional integral. And we have a loop momentum k mu, where mu is 0 to 3. Now this goes to k mu. But now the loop momentum can have components not just in the 4 dimensions, but also in the extra d minus 4 dimensions. D minus 1. And that means that I need additional gamma matrices as well. This. All right. Now there's a subtlety for gamma 5. In 4 dimensions, it was defined the following way, just I, gamma 0, gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3. You might say I could define gamma 5 just by, you know, if I have extra dimensions, I just keep multiplying additional gamma matrices. That doesn't work out, OK? And you may know this already, I don't know, if you have, for example, an odd number of dimensions, there's no additional gamma 5 you can define. And so in a sense, gamma 5 doesn't really generalize to different numbers of dimensions. You can define it in even numbers of dimensions. But if I'm imagining going to additional dimensions, then it ends up being a little bit problematic. And actually, there's no generalization for gamma 5. in, you know, general d dimensions, where it still anti-commutes with all of the gamma mu's. Okay. Now, okay, so what we do is as follows. We keep gamma 5 to be this. All right, that means that gamma 5 will still anti-commute with all of the gamma mu's, as long as mu is just the normal 0, 1, 2, and 3. But if I have gamma mu being one of the additional components, then it won't anti-commute anymore, but it'll actually commute. Like, you can imagine if I had a gamma 4 here that I wanted to pass through, it would anti-commute with 4 of these, and I'll just get a plus sign. So it can, so the rule is that gamma 5 gamma mu is equal to 0. For mu is 0, 1, 2, and 3. But it commutes with gamma mu for components beyond the normal 4. OK. I'm running a little bit low on time, but I'll just have another 5 minutes, if that's OK. And we can try to wrap it up. But this is really the subtlety here that I wanted to emphasize. Once you resign yourself to this, the rest of it is not so hard. OK. So that is the kind of the point here, that I have to divide up my loop momentum k in the following way. So I have to separate k mu as the components parallel to the usual 4 dimensions, usual 3 plus 1 dimensions, plus the component perpendicular to the usual, so these are the extra d minus 4 dimensions. OK, so you're just dividing it up into components along 3 of the dimensions, and then whatever is left over. Now, k slash would just be k slash parallel plus k slash perpendicular. And then I have to use this rule that if I have k slash parallel, it will anti-commute with gamma 5. But k slash perpendicular will commute with gamma 5. OK? So anytime I'm commuting or anti-commuting a gamma 5, so anytime I'm passing a gamma 5 through one of these k slashes, I have to first divide it into the parallel components and the perpendicular components, and then I have to use a different rule for one versus the other. OK. So now let's go back to this identity here. So this is what we wanted to impose in order to get 0, and so we'll see how this breaks down. Note that you have q slash times gamma 5. So this I can write again as p slash 1 plus p slash 2 times gamma 5. And this is p slash 1 plus k slash minus k slash plus p2 gamma 5. And so I have this term, which I'll keep just as is, k slash plus p1 slash gamma 5. And then this term here, I have to divide the k slash into perpendicular and parallel. So we'll have, so I'll write this as k slash parallel plus k slash perpendicular. Now when I move the gamma 5 through, the parallel and the P-slash will get minus signs, but the K perpendicular will just keep the same sign. And so I can write it like this. Gamma 5, I have K slash, so I've got a plus sign here. So it's plus K parallel minus K perpendicular, and then minus P2 slash. OK, so this is just using the rules. And then I can add here minus K slash parallel plus K slash parallel. So I'm just adding 0. And now this one will combine with this one to give me K slash, but I'll still have left over a minus 2 K perpendicular slash. So all together, this gives me K slash plus P1 slash, gamma 5, and then minus, plus gamma 5 of K slash minus P2 slash minus 2 gamma 5 K perpendicular slash. OK? So these two terms are what I had before. And I can use the same logic as I had before. These terms will cancel. Terms will vanish by antisymmetry. But I still have this part left over. So I have some additional part that still survives, which gives me something non-zero. OK. So I'll just write down where we are. We have I for diagram 1, nu beta is now this d-dimensional integral. I have the trace of minus 2 gamma 5 k slash perpendicular k slash minus p2 slash gamma beta k slash gamma nu k slash plus p1 slash. And then all of this is over k squared, k plus p1 squared, k minus p2 squared. OK? Now the next steps are just a little bit annoying algebraically. And there's nothing too complicated about it. You just have to use the same follow-your-nose approach to doing loop integrals. You use Feynman parameters. To combine the denominator, and then you define a new loop momentum integral from K to L. And then you have to evaluate the integrals. And there's nothing very complicated about this, but then at the end of the day, you end up with the following results. So you get minus I over 32 pi squared, the trace of minus 2 gamma 5 p2 slash gamma beta gamma nu p1 slash. So this is after doing the expanding and Feynman parameters, defining our new loop integral, then we integrate over the d-dimensional integral over L, and then we integrate over the Feynman parameters. So it's just a bunch of steps. But then we get this. And then at the end of the day, we can evaluate this trace. We get 1 over 2 pi squared, epsilon mu nu alpha beta, P1 mu, P2 beta. Okay, so I should say it's a fourth. And then when we combine it with the other diagram, we just get a factor of 2. Okay. So this is it. This was what I had written down without any justification last time. And so you at least saw the bones of a proof of how you would derive it. If you want to go through these steps in more detail, they're all in my notes. And so you can follow through those steps as you like. OK, that is all.